What's up? Welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have Hersha Prague all the way from Johannesburg. Hersha was a former head of planning of JWT. She's currently a freelance strategist. And today we're going to talk about how the skills that people who do strategy work have, how they can help right things, because in a lot of people's minds, there's a lot of wrong things going on right now. Welcome, Hersha.
Hi there, Mark. And thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited.
Let's start with the big topic of diversity. You live in a country that has a population way bigger than I actually realized. And at the same time, there are 11 languages in South Africa, correct? How does one go about doing strategy work right now in South Africa? And especially with this mindset of trying to represent more of the people who live in a particular place?
To be honest, doing strategy work in South Africa is probably the most exciting thing that you can do. Just to recap a bit on South Africa's history, we've had quite a challenging past and that we've now sort of 20 years into our democracy. And really, if I can just recap the past very briefly, we had a system called apartheid, which literally means to keep apart or to keep separate. And so our previous government literally took different cultural groups and placed them together in separate locations. And so we were physically, geographically separated from each other in terms of where we were allowed to work, where we were allowed to go to school, the kinds of public amenities that we had access to. And so what that means is that up until 20 years ago, we never really interacted with somebody that was not similar to ourselves in terms of race and culture. So as a strategist, you're actually almost every day trying to do strategic thinking, trying to find insights of people that have lived in your country for generations, but you don't actually really know their life experience at all. And when you first start out as a strategist, and I know I made this mistake several times, you try and place yourself in their shoes in a very vanilla kind of way and say, well, this is what it must be like, as if they were a character in a book or a play. And the kind of insights that you're getting from there are really very shallow and superficial. And our industry has really done that for the longest time. I'd say for the last 15, maybe even 18 years, that has been the kind of response that we've had to the complexity and diversity of this country. What we're doing now in sort of the last 4 to 5 years, we're seeing strategists, brands, clients, everybody really in the industry trying to move past the superficial, let me place myself in this person's shoes or that person's shoes, and really actually just go and live the experience. 11 official languages are probably the least difficult, tricky thing about us. The most difficult thing about us is the stereotypes and the labels that we have about each other. And they really stem from the misinformation that our past delivered onto us. I mean, really, it was a political campaign of misinformation and also just the lack of knowledge and understanding. So, yeah, I think the key to doing strategy in South Africa, to do it really well, is to have absolute empathy and to go beyond putting your feet in somebody's shoes, but really to have empathy for the experience, because it is so different from what you've grown up with.
So what does the phrase absolute empathy mean to you?
So for me, it would literally be stripping yourself out of your identity and putting yourselves in their identity from a fresh perspective. And the way I do it is I always imagine that I'm a visitor to this country. And if I take away all my assumptions of what Indian people, and I'm Indian, of what Indian people are supposed to be like versus black South Africans versus white South Africans versus our mixed race South Africans, which we called colored South Africans, and they have an interesting history as well. If I remove all of the assumptions I've made and the judgments and the conclusions I've drawn, and then I step into their life, and not from my computer and looking at Google or YouTube videos, actually going to where they live, spending an afternoon having tea and cake or something, or going, you know, to the bar, that's what absolute empathy is. But then you start to realize that, unlike me, where I had quite a privileged upbringing, a privileged middle-class upbringing where my parents could take me where I wanted to go with a car, most South Africans still today, about a third of us, still don't have access to basic sanitation services. Mm-hmm. A third of South Africans. Wow. And so for me to pretend to understand their reality, I can't do that sitting in a boardroom. I have to actually say, well, let me go live with them for a day or two, which I know is not always possible. But if you can actually say, well, what would that feel like? What would that be? Let me at least go spend a few hours there. That's when you get to this absolute empathy and say, well, actually, they don't even know what it's like to have sanitation that works all the time. They've actually never experienced it. Then you start thinking about talking to them in a completely different way. It opens you up.
Well, can I get you to explain what you think empathy is as well? Because it is one of those words that we often use. It can get confused with a lot of different things, words like sympathy, for example. What does it mean to you?
Mm-hmm. For me, empathy is, and again, that is why I use the term of learning versus judging. So if you're judging a person or situation, then it's more sympathy to say, oh, poor thing, they don't have this, or, oh my God, look at this person, they have this versus me. Empathy for me, and when I talk about having a learning mindset, you're learning without judging. That's what the empathy is for me. We're saying, okay, this is what this person's experience of life is like in South Africa. And without judgment, let me actually truly feel what this feels like. Let me understand what they struggle with, what they're hoping for, what they're dreaming about, and what they're deciding to spend their last 50 Rand on this month.
Hmm. Can you ever have absolute empathy, or is absolute just a dramatic way to get people's attention and to get them out of buildings and office rooms?
I think for me, it's a hopeful way of looking at it. If you think of the history of our country, and we're still, many of us are still, I guess, stuck or rooted in the past where we believe certain cultural types are a certain way. And so the only way I can really get through to my colleagues and my clients is to talk about it with a sense of fanaticism, to say you have to take yourself out of your reality. And I know it's terrible to tell anybody you have to do something, because it's not really true. But my perspective has always been that if you radically alter your judgments and radically alter the conclusion that you've made, or at least put them aside, you give yourself the best hope of understanding and truly empathizing what this other person's life is all about. And then that's where you get the insights that you need to create the work that we need to do.
Okay. And this shift that you're talking about over the past 20 years to include more voices, more faces, more different types of opinions and attitudes and beliefs, and spending more time with people in South Africa outside of, I guess, one or two particular privileged groups. Did that change happen just because it made good business sense?
Gosh, that's a good question. I think yes, because it made good business sense. And also I think because the more diverse people we have coming in, the more diverse talent that we have coming into agencies and into the client side, are realizing that the people that make the decisions really don't understand the customers that they're marketing to. And I think the push is coming from that side as well. But I mean, having said all of this, there are companies like Unilever, for example, where a good friend of mine worked. And so I know her experience when she first started many years ago as a brand manager. Their approach to understanding consumers was very much like what I've been talking about. So it's because they're a global body that understands the need from a business point of view to really understand what you're selling to and what you're marketing towards as well.
It's interesting because I think there can be this little nugget of dissonance that happens for many people who do strategy work, where often they've got good brains, good intentions, they're creative spirits. There aren't that many professions where you can earn a decent salary by combining all of those things. Many professions would ask that kind of person to turn down at least their creative bent, if not their curiosity, their desire for curiosity and to express themselves. So there aren't that many professions, but I can imagine an observer would find that there is dissonance between talking about empathy while trying to work out how to sell stuff to people. And especially in a country where there is so much poverty, that the idea of using empathy to sell to people who may not even have much might seem like a huge chunk of dissonance. How do you calibrate yourself through that dissonance?
So I struggled with that dissonance myself for a number of years until I realized that our country being in the state that it is in, and if I qualify what that statement means, We've got a government with a huge number of problems to solve, and they're unfortunately not as efficient or as effective as they could be. And so with that challenge ahead of us, or sort of surrounding us, what I realized is that then it was an opportunity for me as the strategist on a brand or in a business to really challenge the business to go beyond marketing and to actually say, well, if our purpose is to make lives easier, or to help children really learn, or to provide financial well-being to people, how can you do that in a way that extends beyond product and that extends beyond marketing communications? And in a country like South Africa, if you think about it in this way, suddenly your role becomes that much more exciting. And also, for me, it became a privilege to do what I do. And I'll explain why I say a privilege. In our country, we have potholes frequently, as in many third world countries. However, our government is not really able to see to them. And so we had a company a while back, they came up with a campaign where, and they were insurance companies, so it made sense. They would, you simply had to dial their toll-free number and they would come and fix it for you. And already then you're demonstrating your purpose to make consumers' lives easier. That was a small campaign that ran for maybe a few months or a year, but it had such a major impact on the brand and in terms of fundamentally changing people's lives. The one big campaign in South Africa that we are all excited about and that we're all super grateful for, and this is why I say whoever the strategist or creative or what if I take the titles away, the person who thought of this, whoever they are, thank you very, very much from all of South Africa. We frequently also, our traffic lights, or as we call them in South Africa, our robots, frequently stop working when it starts to rain. They seem to be allergic to the rain. And we don't have the kind of manpower where we have pointsmen directing the traffic, certainly not in our traffic department. And so there's another insurance company called OutSurance, which has been doing this for years. They simply supply the manpower to A, reduce accidents so they don't have as many claims, and B, to literally save hours of our life every single day. I mean, there's a road close to where I live where there's a light that is out every single day. It's for humongous lane. Thousands of cars go through there every single hour. And because the OutSurance pointsman is there, our lives are dramatically altered. And it's not a big idea, but it's an idea that it's something that the government couldn't do, that some team of really smart, creative people came up with. And if I was part of that team, I'd feel like I've done something positive for the country because I have. And so that lessens the dissonance. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about it in that way, it becomes a privilege to do the work that we do because you can actually affect real change in communities' lives. And yes, some people may think it's a little bit gimmicky, of course, but even though it can be gimmicky, you're still fundamentally changing the physical nature of what's going on in that space. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have that opportunity if you weren't at an agency or at a client using the big budgets and the big brain power of these big brands.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It sounds like there are a few ways to answer that dissonance. And one of them is just to say, well, we live in a capitalist society and that's about making money, and there are good and not good, intended and unintended, good and not good things that come from that. The second point that can come up is that, well, we all sell, so there's nothing wrong with that. And anybody who owns money, there is someone in that company selling stuff so that they can earn that money. And then we get the idea of hoping we can help people through strategy work. And then it sounds like with some of your work and what's been happening in South Africa, the idea of representing more types of people in advertising is also a way to deal with that dissonance. There's just this hope that you're doing more good than less good. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And if I could just add one thing that I didn't mention, but that I'm certainly being a part of now with the clients that I have, that is also very exciting for me, is working as a strategist to help clients come up with new products and services that actually answer the needs of consumers in a very real way and in a very different way. So, for example, I'm working with fintech companies right now that are devising product solutions for third world countries that make sense in our market. And being able to be a part of a team that's creating a product that isn't just a new flavor of soup or toothpaste, but a product that actually fundamentally changes the way people save or purchase things, That is exciting to me. And that, again, for me is a privilege because I'm getting to be a part of engineering something useful for the market.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I thought our industry was going to become more of that. And I was probably from the age of 19 to 28, I was in more of the digital parts of agencies and not always full time. And I was a bit reluctant to get involved with the advertising world, and the creative departments and the more mainstream parts of any agency that I was in didn't really want much to do with us. Then when I was 28, I moved into more like the, I guess what people call, it's a funny title, the more mainstream parts of the agency. And there was a year or two where I totally bought into the idea of being able to do useful things, to create things that would help people's lives. There was that old phrase of value exchange jargon that people talk about. And then I've got to say, in the past 5 years, I found in America, at least, that advertising is more advertising than ever. And those sorts of ideas just waste people's time. And it's partly because of the person's budget and what they're looking for. So the work that you're doing now, are you going through a marketing department or an innovation department, a CEO? How are you getting that kind of work?
I'm getting that kind of work through the management team and also with working alongside entrepreneurs. I guess I've been really lucky in that this is what I've been wanting to do. And so the opportunities have been coming my way and I've been jumping at the chance to be able to be a part of it. So yes, I understand, and I went through it myself actually a few years ago when it became very popular to find solutions to things, and you're absolutely correct. We wasted a lot of time and energy creating these new product solutions that the client hadn't actually briefed us for and didn't have the budget and quite frankly wasn't interested in hearing about. And that's, I guess, one of the reasons why I decided to move out on my own. And so this is an option for many of the listeners out there, is to move out on your own, as scary as it can be, because you don't have a fixed idea of where the next project is going to come from. It has opened me up to do the kind of work that I really want to do, to be in the space that where my talents, as you mentioned earlier, the creativity, the analytical mind, the desire to problem solve, can actually be used to affect real change.
And so how do you apply your planning skills to these kinds of projects, and what kinds of activities do you do? How do you approach research? How do you summarize the research?
Well, when you're working with a management team that are very keen to effect change, the rules suddenly that used to hold me back in terms of this is my box and I should stay here and this is their box have suddenly disappeared. The biggest thing that I do, I think, differently is that I really go in with a sense of collaboration and not this desire of I need to be this role and they are that role. So it is this very different kind of collaboration. We look at insights and research in a much more streamlined way because there's no need to prove to people sitting in many offices around the world or people that are very far removed from the consumers that you're wanting to service. We look at insights very differently in that we really just go in there, and once it makes sense, it settles into your intuition, you get that aha moment, we go for it and we test and we see what happens and be prepared. And again, I'm going to be sounding like perhaps every other podcast that you've heard before, but it really is that you've got to put a step forward, be prepared that it may fail or it may succeed, but either way, you're going to learn something. And that's what we do. And then also I work with very, very, very smart clients who've got teams behind them that really do know what they're doing from a technology perspective that I can't even hope to explain adequately. And so it is a meeting of two very enthusiastic groups of people that want to find a solution. And so we are trying to.
Can you talk to me a bit about companies that you think are doing a good job of representing the diversity of South Africa in their advertising?
I didn't actually have to think very long and hard about this. The company, and I've chatted to a few of my colleagues and quite a few people, and the brand that comes to mind is a local fast food chicken brand called Nando's. I'm not sure if you've heard of them. Mm-hmm. They are in Australia and the UK as well. And what they do really brilliantly is they don't try and connect us together with an insight that feels like a forced group hug. So they look at things that really tick us all off in the same way, and then they build communication around that. They do it being a fast food brand. Then obviously it's not a very serious brand, and they're able to use a lot of humor. But they take the things that really tick us off as a nation, and then they build communication around that, which is just, it's hilarious, it's entertaining, but it's also, it's brilliant in that moment you forget which culture you are, you forget which agenda you're driving, and you're just laughing at what they're saying.
I love that phrase. I mean, you could have the question, what ticks us all off, as part of a creative brief, and it's much more suggestive, obviously much more suggestive than even the word insight, where a lot of people flail around not always knowing what one is or how to write one or whether it's any good. Whereas the simple question, well, what ticks us all off and can you prove this, is loaded and ripe for fun. That's really interesting. What's an example?
Okay. So as part of our maturing as a continent and as a country, we're seeing this rise of, and sorry, I want to choose my words carefully here so that I'm clear. We're seeing a rise of Afrocentric identity. And what I mean by that, beyond the buzzwords, is Black South Africans are redefining who it is that they think they are and what it is that they want from life. And the reason why this is so important is that we've, as you know, a lot of the world, we've had a very long history of colonial influence, which distorted our story of who we are. And then we had the apartheid system, which radically distorted who we are, because any person of color was told that they're a second or third class citizen versus who was in power. And so we've got our black youth that are dismantling all of those old ideas and filling it in with more positive, I guess, positive is not the wrong, right word, with more authentic ideas of who they are. So, and we're trying to figure this out. And there are brands out there, especially alcohol brands, that are trying to figure this out with these consumers. And so a lot of the advertising in the last sort of year or two, the stories that we're telling, has a certain look and feel to it. A kind of like a, what was that movie? The Marvel movie that came out. Oh, gosh, was it Marvel DC? The Panther movie, Black Panther?
Yeah, Black Panther.
So that sort of futuristic Afrocentric fusion of stuff blowing up and high tech, etc. And we're trying to bring that into our advertising today. And it was all starting to look and feel the same. And then Nando's brings out an advert that says, well, is this who we are now, South Africa? Like TVs blowing up, people riding on elephants, people looking like kings and queens of old. And it was just, it was soft because it was, I guess, poking some fun at the advertising industry, but also doing it in a way where the consumer is part of the hidden joke. And that was really delightfully funny and very simple. They're also, what they're really good at is roasting politicians. So again, with any third world country with a high degree of corruption and youth, and gosh, there's so many things that our government is up to at the moment. And so Nando says the things that we are too scared to say or don't know how to say. And they do it brilliantly. So whenever something scandalous happens in the news, which is literally every week, you then go and search to say, okay, what is the Nando's response to this? And then that's what's, you know, kind of ties us back in together.
And are any of the brands getting called out for, especially the brands that have been around for a few decades that maybe have recently had an epiphany, a convenient epiphany? And, you know, Gillette's been called out about this, the fact that they tried to peddle a certain kind of masculinity for a very, very long time. And the margins they make on their blades are crazy expensive. And now they're all about a different kind of masculinity. And so on the one hand, there's a thread there because it's about what does masculinity mean. But at the same time, they were peddling a pretty, I didn't feel good watching their ads growing up. And they're doing it in the name of making a lot of money without necessarily changing their business model very much. Are there local brands that are getting called out for that? That it's just way too soon, way too convenient for them to start reflecting what could be seen as a contemporary South Africa, having spent years of doing the very opposite of that?
So post our first democratic election, every brand out there tried to tell this beautiful, idealized rainbow nation story. Because Nelson Mandela had given us the name of a rainbow nation, and we were all determined to rise up to that, I guess, hopeful statement. And so every ad that you would see, you'd see a Black South African family, a White South African family, a colored South African family, an Indian South African family. And they'd all be having a barbecue together or having lunch together. And back then, that never happened because literally it hadn't been allowed to happen. But that's the kind of advertising that we started to see for the longest time. So you always had one person of every race. You had like the token family of each one. And that didn't really offend anyone because it was what we wanted to see in terms of where we wanted to go. And now we're getting to the stage where I guess brands that were very much targeted towards affluent white South Africans are now trying to find their footing with middle class and lower income black South Africans, because that really is where the disparity lies between white South Africans and black South Africans. And some brands have gotten it right, and some brands have gotten it horribly, horribly wrong. And it really is driven by the fact that the people making these ads are not representative of the people they're selling to. And so they've made horrible faux pas. I won't go into the details, but there have been some cringeworthy moments and some backlash moments, but we also see brands that are also trying to do better. The way I see it is it's almost like this awkward tango that you're doing. And at any given moment, you can, you know, put your step wrong and throw your partner onto the floor. And I think every marketer and advertiser knows that this is the risk that you run, because you never know if something that you do is going to just be seen in a slightly different way to what you intended, and then it falls flat completely, or worse, it angers a huge part of your consumer base. And again, that's why I go back to having this empathy, this understanding of who you're actually speaking to. It is a tightrope that we walk on every single day. It's not easy. I don't think it's going to be easy anytime soon. And yes, to answer your question, companies have made big mistakes, but also, yes, companies have made huge, brilliant moves that have won so many people over as well.
As there's been this push to representing more of South Africa in advertising, has there also been a pullback? You know, we see in various countries that the more progressive, the more diverse things get, and then the more that gets represented, that there's an equal and opposing force that wants to go back to how things were. Is that a loud voice in South Africa?
No, not at all. I mean, we have certain groups of people that, yes, may, from a purely political reason, talk about the past, but that's certainly not in any of the conversations that I've had, something that people even think about. We just can't as a country and as a society, because we've still got so much work to do to move forward. And so there are still brands that are doing the Rainbow Nation, where you've got a token member of every family. That still happens. It's not offensive, because now you do actually go to a barbecue where you have different cultures mixing together. There's now, you know, we were able to go to school, mix schools, etc. So that is more of a reality now than what it was 20 years ago or 15 years ago. So that kind of depiction happens, but it's not offensive. But we can't ever go back to what it was before.
And this is a clumsy, broad question, but how diverse is the advertising community itself?
I don't think that we are very diverse. It's definitely most certainly getting better. And diversity from our perspective, it's not so much the male-female diversity that I'm speaking about, though the industry is more male-orientated. It's more the diversity in terms of from a racial perspective and from an income and lifestyle perspective. And so many of our management teams are still very much coming from the affluent, privileged background, and not just from the agency side, from the client side as well. And I think that's important to realize, because the clients ultimately make the decisions. We've got lots of new young talent coming in, but it really isn't enough. Because, you know, when you first start out, you can't really voice your opinions in the way that you need to. And so those voices are not always getting heard. So some agencies do this better than others, but as a whole, it could be a whole lot better. And we'll know it when we start seeing communication that as they're working on the tightrope is doing really well, instead of having all of these missteps that we see as we go along.
Now, as you were a head of planning, with obviously planners working for you, unless you were a single planner and a head of planning, for other people who are moving into that kind of leadership role, do you have any advice for how they can try to increase the diversity of their teams?
So, okay. So from a hiring perspective, you are seeing the move to hire people from more diverse backgrounds. And that is a good step. But I think for me, what I realized and what I wish I had done more of back when I was in that role was really spend time with my planners in their lives and see what it is that they were bringing to the table. So going back to my idea of empathy, so we, JWT being the, I guess, strategic agency that it was when I was there, It was very much, this is the way, this is how we do strategy, this is how we do insights, this is how we do that, et cetera, et cetera. And I wish at the time that I'd taken more time, I guess placed more energy in seeing where they come from and letting them teach me. And so for any planners or heads of planning out there, my key lesson would be let them teach you, because there are experiences that they've had that we can't even begin to have. And when you let them teach you, that's when you're really embracing the diversity and also opening yourself up to the learning mindset.
Mm-hmm. Now, that does assume that people from different backgrounds are getting in the door. What if they're not getting in the door? How can a head of planning find more people with different types of backgrounds? Because it is one of those weird professions that a lot of people don't know about. And then when they know mm-hmm. about it, they really want to be in it. But it still seems quite, it's a quiet profession.
It's so what I would also recommend then is doing internships. So if you've got people with backgrounds that you don't know if they're going to fit or not, let them into the company for a month or two and see how they work and see what it is that they bring. And it is a very practical solution, but that's what worked for me in the past. And then you see, okay, this person could work. Let's see if we can find a solution for them.
And then how do you find more of these people?
So there's some planners that are really good at sharing their, or heads of planning at sharing their points of view on social media. So for those, I'd say, you know, the people that listen and comment, engage with them and see maybe they can come into your team, because that's always a good place to start. As you know, they're looking to you for inspiration, but at the same time, they can inspire you right back. So that's how I would look at it. And secondly, going to, I'm a big speaker. I like talking to people. So I'm always out and about with different kinds of people, trying to figure out what their life stories are all about. Yeah, that kind of exposed me to more people, and telling them what I do also gave them an idea of, oh, this is possible too. And then thirdly, just going out and speaking to schools. So you're absolutely correct that strategy is a role that most people don't know about. I would actually recommend that more heads of planning go out to schools, go out to what we call high schools or secondary schools in the last 2 years where students are deciding what they want to do. Go out there and show them what advertising is all about and what strategists do, because that's when they're deciding what they want to become, what they want to study, and that's actually where we need to start talking.
Do you have a point of view on whether a strategist or a planner needs a college degree or a university degree, especially coming from a country that has such different life outcomes, different, you know, mm-hmm. it's like to be able to go to college means, or university means that you finish school. To have finished school might mean you have had to come from a family that had was able to get you through school, and that's not always possible, right?
Gosh, this is a tricky question to answer. I think in a country like ours, having a university degree is helpful because it trains you in terms of how to think and how to approach a problem. And our school, our government schools in this country are notoriously not good at doing that. And so our education system is very flawed at this point in terms of teaching people to think. And the only time that students really get a chance to learn how to think and how to problem solve is in university. So because that is the case, for our country, I would recommend that a university degree is essential, because you're not being taught those critical skills at school. If our schooling system was a million times better and more suited to creative problem solving, then my point of view would change.
I want to talk to you a little bit about regrets, but I don't mean it in a big way. But, you know, we did start off by talking about writing things, and you mentioned that one of the things you would write if you were back as a head of planning right now is to spend a bit more time in the lives of your planners. Are there any other things that you would do differently with the knowledge and experience that you have now?
Yes, absolutely. I would go into my projects and collaborations and briefings and meetings with more humility, definitely. Back then, being a young planner, very ambitious and wanting to get to the next level, I always thought that I had to know all the answers, and I always thought that I had to be right. And I placed this incredible burden on myself. I always thought I had to be the smartest person in the room. And on the one hand, like my colleagues and my clients got the very best work out of me. But on the other hand, I'm sure I must have been frightfully irritating to everyone. If I could do it all again, I would tell myself, have a very stern conversation to say, you are not the smartest person in the room. You don't have to know everything. And you absolutely can say, I don't know. As I've gotten more experienced and more mature, being able to say that gave me the best solutions from everybody else in the team than I could have possibly hoped to have gotten by myself.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other things that you would do differently?
Gosh, probably drink more tequila at all those agency meetings instead of trying to be, I need to be the sober one to get everyone home. So, that was just me kidding. But I think that's the best part the most fun part of agency life. I think seriously now, I would have more fun with what I was doing. I always took things very seriously. I think it's a character trait of many strategists. Because you are so earnest about finding the right solution or the best solution, yes, that is important, but actually have more fun. Because when you're having fun, when you're approaching problems with a playful attitude or perspective, the answers come so much faster and so much more beautifully. So have more fun in what you're doing. But it is fun. It's one of the best jobs in the world. It's a privilege to do.
I love that. I mean, we do reflect the environments we're in to some degree, and then a lot of us are not all of us, but a lot of us are a bit serious and earnest and introverted. And then I think we go back to this other dissonance in that if we don't take our work seriously in companies and with clients who often don't know what to do with us, then we worry that they won't take our work seriously as well. So that might affect it to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. But I my aha moment came when I was doing a creative / strategic brainstorm with my creative team, and they were very clear in telling me where I was adding value and where I was not. And for some reason, I had gone into that brainstorm in a very playful mood. And we did such amazing work that day. That should have been my first clue. So it wasn't that I didn't take myself, that I didn't take what I did seriously. It was just that I approached what I was doing with more playfulness. And when you can differentiate between the two, so you're still coming completely prepared. Your aim is to get the best work possible, but you're not taking yourself so seriously. That's when the magic happens.
Yeah, I agree. All right, last question. With the next generation of planners and with the theme of writing things, what are things that you hope the next generation of planners has the opportunity to write in their work, in their industry, and in their lives?
Gosh, I think, and I've been thinking about this for a while now, it's really owning our value. Owning our value as strategists, in that we're not always trying to prove what it is that we're bringing to the table. We're accepting or acknowledging in ourselves, this is what I bring to the table, and then delivering that. Because when you own your value, you suddenly start approaching problem solving in a much more empowered way. And so that, and I know I'm speaking in a very sort of, I guess, internal, or not internal is the wrong word, but insular way. So looking at the our own sense of our own value. That's what I'd like to see strategists doing going forward. Because once you own your value of how creative we are, how smart we are, how analytical we are, how insane we can be as well, because I'm sure there's that as well, we can start doing many more things that we think are perhaps out of our reach. So when you see how much you can actually bring to the table and you acknowledge that yourself, suddenly the world is your oyster. So to have somebody like me that thought, well, you know, trying to solve problems in an agency is not something that my clients want me to do, to now say, well, let me work with the clients that actually want a strategic brain on the premises. I could only do that once I started acknowledging the value I bring to every conversation I have.
I love that. And I would emphasize that there are two points in what you're saying with the idea of owning your value. One is owning your value as a planner within marketing and advertising. The second is owning your value as a creative spirit. I think a lot of us have spent years allowing a company to determine our creative value, as opposed to showing how valuable we are to that company, and also expressing that value in the outside world, outside of the work that we do.
And absolutely.
And that's the life that follows us our entire life. And too many of us dim it for too long, and it leads to so many psychological problems.
Absolutely. When I was in the client side of my career, I was allowed to be creative. But the moment I got into the agency world, I wasn't the creative, I was a strategist. And yet, if I just said, well, I'm creative too, then suddenly, you know, I mean, so much more, I could have accessed so much more of my ability and my talents and bring it to the table. And so for me, that's been the biggest, I guess, biggest blessing, biggest liberating moment, is to know that I can actually be as much of me as I want to be. So I can be analytical some days, I can be creative, I can be serious, I can be playful, I can be all of those things. And each of those aspects of ourselves bring value. Each of those bring value to the people around you and to the products and the brands and the businesses that you're working on. So never ever doubt that. And never let anybody tell you what you can and can't do, because who are they to know anyway?
I agree. And I think that sentence you said, which is, I can be as much as I want to be, I think that's when you become an adult. And sometimes people never reach that point. Sometimes they reach it very young. But to me, that is adulthood, it's humanhood. And
yes.
the rest of the time, we are kind of the robots, like the traffic lights you mentioned, not always working, yes. or not working when the rain comes. And as soon as you realize that you can be as much as you want to be and that you commit yourself to it and then do stuff to bring it to life, that's when you become a human. I'm being a little bit cheeky and dramatic with that, but that's what I feel right now.
But I absolutely agree. I love that idea of you become a human, because that explains the journey that I've been on in the last 2 years. Is really becoming a human. And so I'm going to use that. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
Because before there were all these boxes and all these tick boxes. And if you just remove all of that and have actually radical empathy for yourself, the whole world becomes your oyster. It's actually so much fun, because you get to say, who do I want to be today? Oh, this part of myself. Okay, let's play with this now. And I'm still doing amazing strategic, smart work. But I guess what's different is that I'm enjoying the experience holistically and having fun. And yeah, life is awesome.
With that shift, there's almost another question, which is, how can I bring myself to life today?
Yes. Oh, that is brilliant. Absolutely, yes.
We're making Carl Jung and a bunch of philosophers proud.
Absolutely. My question really every day, and it's similar to yours, is what feels light for me today? Yeah. And it's not about this like vague happiness or whatever, because that could be a chocolate every morning, which I can absolutely do. It's just out of this project, what feels light for me today, this piece of work. And then that's what I go with.
I agree. I've been working all kinds of hours recently, nothing crazy. But if I want to, you know, write or get my stuff together on the weekend, I'll do it. And then yesterday morning, which was a weekday, I decided to go watch Aquaman with my wife. And I asked that question, what's a good thing to do? I was feeling a little bit burnt out. And halfway through Aquaman, I was like, this was not the right thing to do, but let's try to enjoy it anyway. But it's a good question.
Yeah, Aquaman is very hectic, so you need to be in the right frame of mind to watch that.
Oh, the dialogue was, I just can't watch
it. It was terrible. The dialogue was terrible, but the effects were amazing.
Yeah, if you're going to spend all that money on effects, at least spend a little bit of money on the words, at least.
Yes.
Hersha, where can people find you on the internet?
So I have a Twitter handle. It's Hersha_Prague. And then I'm also on Instagram, and it's my name, Hersha Prague as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Sweathead.
Thank you very much, Mark. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Awesome. Continue to write those things. Peace.